Almost every human emotion is covered in Ellington's music. I would think of William Shakespeare. This whole heightened sense of understanding what the human condition is about.
He rarely ever wrote abstract music. For instance, Ellington said very early in his career with pieces like East St. Louis Tallo that he tried to picture circumstances that gave birth to the music.
Duke represents the ultimate dedication, unwavering in his belief in swinging.
When you think of American song and jazz standards, you think of Duke Ellington. Sophisticated Lady, Mood Indigo, Prelude to a Kiss, In a Sentimental Mood. There are very few jazz musicians or singers who haven't embraced these compositions, keeping them alive for new generations. I'm Nancy Wilson. In this edition of Jazz Profiles, we explore one of the greatest geniuses of modern music, with the first of two shows devoted to Duke Ellington, the composer. Ellington didn't just compose gorgeous melodies that have lasted the better part of a century. He didn't simply create innovative arrangements that still sound as timeless as ever. Duke Ellington orchestrated entire moods. He could evoke scenes as diverse as the train tracks of the Midwest and the urban clatter of uptown New York City.
He had a great affection for Harlem. At a time when Harlem was an exotic place to most people who didn't live there, he found it even more exotic than most.
Pianist and educator Billy Taylor says that compositions like Harlem Airshaft were drawn from Duke Ellington's observations.
He saw something magical about the odors of cooking and the kinds of sounds that one heard in an apartment building where all kinds of people lived.
Thank you. moment could paint a musical picture that planted the listener right inside the Cotton Club, or cultivate the elegance and sway of a sophisticated lady. Ellington got ideas from just walking down the streets of Harlem.
Totoro, you know, is a broken walk.
Duke Ellington.
Practically everything we wrote was supposed to be a picture of something, you know, or it represented a character or something. And this is the thing that we were walking up Broadway one night after playing the Kentucky Club. And we talk about this is an old man after a hard day's work in the field, you know. He's strong, you know, in spite of being so tired, because he's headed for that, if you get his feet under the table and get that hot dinner that's waiting for him. And that's the East St. Louis Totoro.
Duke Ellington's East St. Louis Totoro. It was one of his first big hits and exemplified the way the composer heard life. Listen as Ellington articulates his vision in this recording session of Daybreak Express, documented for the 1937 film Record Making with Duke Ellington. For Duke Ellington, music had no boundaries or categories. His compositions were built on a foundation of harmony, rhythm, and melody that drew upon the blues and other African-American folk idioms. He even incorporated the music of Tin Pan Alley. In the process, Ellington created over 1,000 enduring compositions. He drew from his cultural heritage and gave back in return. Conductor and historian David Berger.
An early mentor of his, Will Marion Cook, said, "You're a black man from America. You should do what the European composers did with their music. They had folk music. You have folk music. Take your folk music and make it into fine art." And for the rest of his life, that's what he did.
Duke Ellington's Mississippi Moan. I'm Nancy Wilson, with a look into the genius of Duke Ellington, the composer, on NPR's Jazz Profiles. Duke Ellington was already in his teens before he got serious about learning the piano. He was attracted at first to the stride players. Ellington picked up pointers by studying his idols as they performed in theaters, bars, and ballrooms. He'd slow their piano rolls down to follow the moving keys with his fingers. Flute Flutist and composer James Newton has recorded many Ellington compositions. He says Ellington used the piano as a way of adapting the jazz being brewed in New Orleans.
The 20s are just phenomenal as far as music is concerned. And I think that's one of the reasons why the New Orleans tradition remained a part of the music, and he was wise enough to not only look at the piano players, but look at the great soloists like Bechet and others and translate their language onto the piano to bring about a more original voice.
Trumpeter and composer Wynton Marsalis says Ellington took many important lessons from New Orleans jazz.
One would be polyphonic writing. A lot of times you hear at the end of a piece, Duke will have the clarinet up high. That's the New Orleans clarinet tradition. Like the band will be playing, that's the New Orleans tradition. Also the accent on the fourth beat.
Ellington's Hophead from March 22, 1927, recorded for the OK label. Saxophonist Sidney Bechet briefly played with the Ellington Orchestra in the mid-1920s, but it was trumpet player Bubba Miley who injected into Duke Ellington's compositions a growling sound reminiscent of Joe King Oliver and New Orleans.
He was learning, he was listening, and he was looking for ways to integrate his star soloist, trumpeter Bubba Miley, thoroughly into the band.
Ellington biographer John Edward Hassey.
All of these early pieces like East St. Louis Totolo and Black and Tan Fantasy were really built to feature Bubba Miley, who had this extraordinary repertory of sounds on the trumpet and deeply influenced Ellington. I believe it was Bubba Miley's playing more than anything else that stimulated the transformation of Ellington's band from a polite society band into a bona fide jazz band.
Take It Easy, featuring Bubba Miley. Trumpeter Wynton Marsalis is a student of Miley's techniques.
You never knew what he was going to do, what would come out of his horn, but you know that whatever came out was going to be soulful and creative. And he influenced the band with the growling and the different type of effects, and also the attitude, that type of soulful arrogance. Now the growl started when you would hum. Humming breaks the note up. If you go So then if you hum and growl at the same time, like that. It's a very physical kind of hard way of playing. And Bubba Marley's way of playing was more elegant, coming out of the King Oliver way. He'd be playing.
While Duke Ellington exploited the vocal qualities of his soloists, like Miley and trombonist Tricky Sam Natten, he was also using the voice itself as an instrument. In the fall of 1927, vocalist Adelaide Hall became a featured instrumentalist on Ellington's Creole Love Call, John Edward Hesse.
In this recording, Creole Love Call, Ellington added a whole new sound to his orchestral colors by having Adelaide Hall sing this wonderful wordless vocal. It was a sound that was unique to the Ellington palette of sounds, and I think stands out in jazz recordings of the 1920s.
Duke Ellington's Creole Love Call with vocalist Adelaide Hall. Duke Ellington was just starting to build a reputation when his fledgling group landed the job as house band at the famed Cotton Club. In the heyday of Prohibition, the Cotton Club was one of the most notorious speakeasies in Harlem. The club's elaborate floor shows forced Ellington to expand his group to 11 musicians. That gave him the opportunity to use instrumental voices and colors in daring new ways. Educator and composer David Baker.
Here's Ellington at the Cotton Club, and he's got to create all these dramatic scenarios. Some of them were attached to a dance that's being done on the stage, where you change the tempo, where you change the mood, where you change the particular effect that you're looking for. You see it in a piece like Echoes of Harlem. Boom, be-dum, bo-dum, be-dum, bo-dum, be-dum, bo-dum. Then to create a different kind of melody to go with that. I think he was ever aware of not just the harmonic implications of a melody, but always what are the things that make it unique when you get to the use of rhythms.
Unfortunately, one of the casualties of the Cotton Club engagement was Bubba Marley. His drinking forced him to leave the band in 1929. Ellington had lost a major player, but with his keen ear for new talent, he soon replaced him with Cootie Williams. Ellington knew the colors and textures he needed for his growing orchestra, and he sought out musicians with their own distinctive personalities and styles. Stretch Johnson, author, historian, and performer.
Ellington had men in his organization from all parts of the country, so that in a sense, the band represented a unity of all of the regional musics, since each musician was kind of an interpreter of his regional music. Barney Bigard, Wellman Broad came from New Orleans, Cootie Williams from Mobile, Alabama, Johnny Hodges, Harry Carney from Boston, Tricky Sam from Jamaica, Arthur Wetzel came from Florida, Juan Tizo from Puerto Rico. And Duke Ellington composed utilizing all of the regional musics and integrating them in each particular work.
Double Check Stomp by Duke Ellington from 1930, featuring trumpeter Cootie Williams, baritone saxophonist Harry Carney, and trombonist Tricky Sam Nanton. Along with alto saxophonist Johnny Hodges and clarinetist Barney Bigard, they were key additions to the orchestra in the late 1920s. The improvised solos played by these musicians often inspired Duke Ellington's compositions.
Duke openly admitted that he wrote a lot of his music by listening to his players.
Duke Ellington drummer, Louis Belson.
Like, he may hear Cootie Williams go, bee, boo, 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 and that's all. And once he heard that, Duke would go, dee, doo, 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 dee, da, doo, dum, do nothing till you hear from me, which was something he wrote for Cootie. You know? So he listened and got ideas from his guys and then was able to mold and write particular songs for each player and then write a full arrangement around that melody.
Duke Ellington thrived during his three-year engagement at the Cotton Club. He became a prolific writer, creating new pieces for the floor shows and for dancing. Live nightly radio broadcasts brought his sound into people's homes across the nation.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to our famous Cotton Club. I'd like to have the pleasure of introducing the greatest living master of jungle music, the rip-roaring harmony hound, none other than Duke Ellington. Take your bow, Dookie. First number tonight's gonna play a brand new little tune entitled The Cotton Club Stomp. Let her go.
Jungle music, one of the sounds Duke Ellington developed at the Cotton Club. His compositions were suffused with deeply rooted rhythmic African-American traditions. James Newton says Ellington's African rhythmic conception was amplified by his drummer, Sonny Greer.
If you look at Sonny Greer's set in the 20s, there's a huge clue for you right there, right away. You think about a great piece like the Mooch and the usage of the tom-toms and also of the temple blocks and just how atmospheric those sonorities become, and all of the polyrhythms that are stacked upon one another, and the fact that he's turned plunger instruments into percussion in a way, because he's making them talk, and all African drums do talk. You know, they have a function. Those rhythms and inflections are translated into words.
Thank you. Duke Ellington with The Mooch from 1930, featuring Sonny Greer on drums. Coming up, Duke Ellington expands the range of jazz composition beyond the 3-minute song. I'm Nancy Wilson. You're listening to the first of two shows exploring the genius of Duke Ellington, the composer, on Jazz Profiles from NPR National Public Radio. By the late 1920s, Duke Ellington had established one of the leading orchestras of the day, and he'd already composed many of the songs that would become jazz standards. For Ellington, writing music was an evolutionary process. Sometimes it would take place at an old upright piano, sometimes in the bathtub. But as he demonstrates in this 1960 interview on the CBC, the birth of a composition was only the beginning of an evolutionary process.
Where did you dream up Sophisticated Lady? Because I
heard Sophisticated Lady.
The first night you broadcast.
Well, that's a composite thing of some girls I knew in Washington who were school teachers. Took me a long time to write it. I think I took longer to write that tune than any tune I ever had in my life. I think it took about 30 days. I'd keep debating and changing my mind about where I wanted to go. I'd get to some place like I could either get to... You hit a big debate. Now, would they go here? Or you get to...
Duke Ellington's classic, Sophisticated Lady. In October 1930, Ellington pared his orchestra down to 6 men for a special radio show. He used Tricky Sam Natten on trombone, Arthur Wetzel on trumpet, and Barney Bigard playing the lower register of his clarinet. They achieved a nocturnal and blues-driven sound for audiences around the country called Dreamy Blues, later retitled Mood Indigo. Trumpeter Wynton Marsalis says Mood Indigo illustrates how the blues underscored even the most elegant of Duke Ellington's compositions.
Mood Indigo would be an example of something that sounds like a blues, but it's not a blues proper. This would be like a blues in the key of C. See, I can't really get to the melody of Mood Indigo. So if I play it just... in there.
Composer and jazz educator David Baker says Ellington's positioning of instrumental voices on Mood Indigo was unprecedented.
Sometimes, to create surprise, he would take that sound that you expected to be in that instrument and put it in another instrument. And that's where the genius and magic comes. Well, for instance, the sound of Mood Indigo, where everything's all upside down. The lowest instrument is on the top. That's calculated.
One of Duke Ellington's finest, Mood Indigo. In the 1920s and 30s, music was cut directly onto 78 RPM records that only held about 3 minutes per side. In 1931, Ellington recorded Creole Rhapsody, an extended work that ran for more than 6 minutes, spreading one piece over two sides of a disc. In a radio interview from 1962, Duke Ellington recalls that the length was quite controversial.
We recorded it on Brunswick and just about got thrown off the label. The idea of using up two sides. They were getting ready to throw me out of there then.
Conductor and composer Gunther Schuller.
Creole Rhapsody is another piece that came from that period, which again had many breakthrough aspects of it, including the fact that it was an expanded piece. It was his sort of initial exploration to try and extend the three-minute limit of jazz. It also dealt with these same explorations in terms of color and combinations and how to use the instruments in different registers and with different mutes and so on. So again, it's one of these prophetic pieces.
Thank you.
Duke Ellington's Creole Rhapsody, recorded on Brunswick Records in January 1931. A signature sound of the Ellington Orchestra was its unusual instrumental combinations. His three-man trombone section was the first of its kind, with Tricky Sam Nanton, Juan Teasel, and Lawrence Brown. It was a unit versatile enough to play in unison or in soaring rhythmic counterpoint to the reeds and brass. Monsignor John Sanders, Ellington's trombonist.
Duke could write for them as a trio of trombones, and the sound that came out was just gorgeous. They could blend with each other. They knew how to complement one another, like chamber music. That's the beauty of chamber players. They know how to work together so closely, and yet, as soloists, they were so different.
Braggin' and Brass, featuring Duke Ellington's elite trombone section. I'm Nancy Wilson, with a look into the genius of Duke Ellington, the composer, on NPR's Jazz Profiles. Duke Ellington's ascending career would soon encounter an unexpected obstacle. His next inspired composition would come in the wake of a sudden and devastating tragedy. Ellington's beloved mother, Daisy, died in 1935.
I just lost my mother, and it looked like the end of everything, you know, and I was on a long tour, and I was down, you know, I was way down, and it was a matter of looking back. It was everything to me in that year was looking back. And I just kept writing, and nothing else really mattered.
What emerged was his breakthrough 11-minute composition dedicated to his mother, reminiscing in tempo. Gunther Schuller.
In my opinion, it's still the best or the most cohesive formally of all the pieces that he wrote. The reason I say that is because it is the only piece in the entire Ellington canon which is a variation piece, even in the strict formal classical sense, that is to say, a piece based on one or two themes which are then varied throughout the piece, and very little other material is interpolated.
Reminiscing in tempo marked a new direction for Duke Ellington as he began to think about longer musical forms. But Gunther Schuller says this change in style was misunderstood.
The sad news is that this is another piece which was totally misunderstood and heavily criticized, to the point where Ellington never performed the piece again. I think he may have performed it once more 5 years later or something, but he was totally destroyed by the negative reaction to this piece.
In the aftermath of Daisy Ellington's death, and with increasing competition from new swing bands, Duke Ellington became less productive. The orchestra's future became less certain. But in 1939, an innovative young bassist from St. Louis, Jimmy Blanton, joined Ellington. Coming on board the following year was the celebrated Kansas City saxophonist, Ben Webster. Together, this Midwestern unit brought a driving rhythmic virtuosity to the orchestra. Ellington was re-energized with his new instrumental arsenal, and his creative output was restored. Pianist and educator, Billy Taylor.
When Blanton came into the band, one of the things that he had to address was rhythm. Blanton's sense of rhythm was different from Duke's or anybody in Duke's generation. And so he had to quickly become accustomed to where Blanton felt the beat and be able to adjust to that, use whatever parts of his vocabulary were necessary to make that work. And he did it admirably.
Jimmy Blanton. It was music like Jack the Bear, Coco, and Cottontail that signaled a new and major period of creativity for Duke Ellington. It wasn't only the genius of Duke Ellington's compositions, it was also his orchestrations. He blended form and texture with the improvisational spirit of his musicians.
What made him unique as a composer is that he was a jazz composer, a folk music composer who had evolved and was evolved into our European culture.
Luther Henderson was one of Duke Ellington's arrangers who began working with him in the 1940s.
His compositions involved a performance. Without the performer, there would be no composition. There would be no concerto for Cootie if it wasn't for Cootie.
And composer James Newton says that Duke Ellington was decades ahead of his time.
The Tamoral experimentation that occurred in the late 20s and 30s were not only revolutionary, but they weren't even really addressed again until we get to the 60s. Just the complexity of human life had grown to such a degree that music had to go in that way again to match the complexity of human existence, and Ellington was already there in the 20s.
Ellington was ahead of his time, but his most productive composing years were still to come, thanks to a unique collaboration with a young writer and arranger named Billy Strayhorn. Billy Strayhorn was a giant talent who literally walked in off the street. His deep musical affinity and his inspirational impact on Ellington is a story that we'll look at in depth next time. Our look into the genius of Duke Ellington is written and produced for Jazz Profiles by Robert Levy. The executive producer is Tim Owens. The studio producer and mix engineer for this program is John DiLiberto. Associate producer, John McDonald. Assistant producers are Jennifer Raskin and Madeline Smith. We'd like to say thanks to our lead advisor, John Edward Hassey. Also, Susan Jenkins, Phil Schaap, Patrick Breslin, producer Margaret Howes, and NPR's Making the Music, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, the Smithsonian's Duke Ellington Archives, and their Jazz Oral History Program, and NPR's New York and Los Angeles bureaus. Special thanks to the New York Foundation for the Arts and to the New York State Council on the Arts for their funding support. This program is a production of National Public Radio in association with Smithsonian Productions, made possible in part by a grant from America's Jazz Heritage, a partnership of the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund and the Smithsonian Institution. To email us, or for more information about this and other programs in our series, contact us through NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org. That's npr.org. Major support for Jazz Profiles comes from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts and culture an active part of their everyday lives. Additional support has been provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is NPR, National Public Radio.